Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What determines how long biological organisms can live and thrive, and can a better understanding of the aging process open the door to longer and healthier human lifespans? It seems a shame that we spend the first part of our lives gaining size and strength, only to find ourselves weaker and more susceptible to disease as we enter our senior years. But as my guest today will tell us, the ways in which plants and animals develop, age, and decline are the result of a complex balance of genetic, evolutionary, and environmental influences. Jonathan Silvertown is professor of ecology at the Open University, Milton Keynes. His new book is called The Long and the Short of It, The Science of Lifespan and Aging. Jonathan, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon.
So one of the most challenging aspects, I guess, of studying lifespan and aging is that the rules are so different depending on what organism one is studying. There are bacteria that live and die within minutes, trees that keep growing for millennia. Are there common factors that affect how long all organisms can live?
There are, actually, yes. I mean, at first glance, there seems to be bewildering variety of how long things live and so on, but the underlying rules, if you like, are fairly straightforward. Firstly, there is basically how reproduction happens. So in animals, most animals, not including corals, which I'll explain in a minute, there is a separation between the cells that become eggs and sperm, and the cells that form the ordinary cells of the body. Mm-hmm. And that means that basically natural selection preserves the integrity of the cells that will form the next generation, the eggs and the sperm, but after a certain amount of time, it kind of gives up on maintaining the body cells. And as a result, you can get aging, you can get senescence. In plants, you don't get that because actually every cell in a plant is capable of producing, in the right circumstances, seeds and another generation. And so natural selection in the case of plants, and as it happens, corals and other colonial animals, as they're called, it kind of preserves those cells from the accumulation of mutations, things like that. So there's two basic ways in which living things are organized. You mentioned bacteria. So bacteria are single-celled. So, of course, they can't separate what's called the germline, the thing that does the reproducing, mm-hmm. from the body cells. And so they, too, are potentially immortal.
Well, we all originated from single-celled organisms, and of course, any organism can live longer if it evolves to multicellularity, but then there are inherent risks to cell division.
Well, yes, there are. A cancer is the big one, of course, because what cancer is the uncontrolled proliferation of cells, particularly when a cancer starts shedding cells that spread around the body and then start multiplying in places, you know, where they cause problems, then that's called metastasis, and that of course is often fatal. That's the stage of cancer you don't want to get to. Mm-hmm. That is a consequence of us being multicellular.
So what kinds of defenses evolved? We know that some humans, some animals get cancers, some plants can get cancers, but what kinds of defenses evolved to keep that from happening to every organism?
Okay, there's a whole range of them. I mean, the first thing is that this kind of uncontrolled, you know, cancer essentially arises through mutation, which kind of destroys some of the genes that stop multiplication happening in an uncontrolled way. And if mutation knocks out some of those genes, then you can get cancers beginning to become more likely at any rate. And so there are all sorts of mechanisms for controlling the mutation rate, for fixing those kind of problems as soon as they occur. One of the big ones, one of the big controls, is also on chromosomes. So the chromosomes are the things in the cell that essentially carry the genes. And each time a cell divides, the chromosomes have to double up. So there's a set of chromosomes in each of the two daughter cells that's produced. And in many organisms, most animals, there are these kind of nubs on the end of chromosomes called telomeres. And what they do is they basically protect the ends of the chromosomes from damage during division. But they get a bit shorter each time you get a cell division happening. And at a certain point, they're used up. And at that point, the cells stop dividing. So it's thought, I think the evidence is very good, that these telomeres are essentially one of the brakes on cancer. They're one of the things that stop cell division just going mad, because it stops cells after a certain number of cell divisions dividing anymore.
Of course, that's a double-edged sword, because my understanding is that we've recently learned that the length of telomeres in any particular body, at least for humans, can be a predictor of how much longer that individual could potentially continue to live.
Well, that's kind of debatable. I think there was one study that suggested that, but lots of other studies have failed to replicate it. And there are some really odd. So this I mentioned just now, sort of how bewildering, if you like, the variety of behavior, if you like, in aging is. And the mouse, which is an organism used a lot in aging studies and other medical studies, it has really long telomeres, but it only lives a very short period of time. So you cannot say in the case of the mouse, and I'm not saying this extrapolates to humans, but in the case of the mouse, you cannot say that it lives a short period of time because it's got short telomeres. It's actually got very long telomeres. So in the case of the mouse, it doesn't really seem to do the job that telomeres, we think, do in other cells, which is to stop cancer happening. So in human, now, you know, among humans, does the length of your telomeres tell you how long you're going to live? I think there are many, many other factors that are just as important. So if telomeres do play a role, it's not so important that it overrides everything else.
Well, with some cells in the body dividing and replacing themselves, you know, a couple of times a week in some cases, it seems that the real wonder is why we don't have more problems over the course of a normal lifespan.
Well, that's absolutely true. I mean, the cells in the gut are replaced twice a week. For obvious reasons, they get kind of washed out. So as you say, you know, some of these cells will have divided thousands and thousands of times during a lifetime. But it's thanks to all these mechanisms that have evolved in animals and plants that, although cancer is not really a problem in plants for reasons I could go into, that we actually can live as long as we do.
So why do plants not live forever? Even though we know some can live what feels like forever to us, every plant that we have found does have a lifespan. Why can't they just keep going always?
Well, lots of good questions here. That's another one. I think the first thing to say is that actually it looks like some plants practically do live forever. But to some extent, this is a matter of how you define what the individual is. So in the Mojave Desert, there are these creosote bushes. And the individual bushes may be only, you know, a few decades old. But underground, they're all connected together by a single root system. So they actually belong together, just like the branches of a tree belong together, except in this case, the branches, if you like, are buried underground. So we tend to, but anyway, let's call this a buried tree, shall we? And then what happens is that over time, these bushes creep outwards in a sort of circular fashion, like a ripple on a pond. It moves very, very slowly. And by measuring the diameter of some of these circular arrangements of bushes, it's been calculated that some of these clones, these bush circles, if you like, are about 11 or 12,000 years old.
And
that's about the same age as the desert itself. Basically, the desert's formed after the end of the last ice age, which was about 11,000 to 12,000 years ago. So for all practical purposes, these plants are immortal. And the reason they can be immortal is the one I mentioned earlier, is that they don't have this separation between the reproductive cells and the body cells. And so natural selection preserves, you know, fight hard to preserve the integrity of the cells. And consequently, plants can live a very long time. So you can do interesting tricks, like you can take the tips off a tree that's old and looks quite decrepit, and you can graft them onto a young tree, and those tips of those shoots are essentially rejuvenated, and they behave just like young shoots on a young tree, even though they were taken from the branch tips of an old tree. And that, what that tells you is that actually the cells in plants are not really aging. What's actually aging, where it does happen, is the wood. It's, if you like, the support structure.
But of course,
and in trees, most of the cells are dead. You know, the wood of the chair I'm sitting in at the minute is dead cells. And the living bit of a tree is just, you know, a small fraction of its total mass. So it's, if you like, plants, trees in particular, the length at which they can stand, how long they can stand up for, depends on how good the wood is, how resistant to rot it is, things like that.
So over time, essentially what a tree is doing is setting up a dead structure around itself, which is the older wood, and then what is newer continues to sprout out from the branches and its new leaves or new needles or whatever the tree produces.
That's it exactly. So, I mean, what happens in many trees is that the center rots away and you get a hollow center to the tree, and then around that is wood, and then around that on the outer surface of the, just beneath the bark, there's a layer of dividing cells, and that on one side, on the inner side of those cells, wood is produced. On the outer side, a tissue called the phloem is produced, and that's what basically transmits the food from the leaves back down to the roots.
But animal bodies and human bodies, of course, don't work that way. We do grow for a period of time, but then the portions that have already grown are very much alive. And I suppose there's a cost in terms of metabolism and how much effort the body takes to keep itself alive.
Sorry, can you just repeat that? I missed the last bit.
I'm not sure. So in other words, there's a cost to keep... once an animal body continues growing and stops growing, it's not like there's just a dead structure that just kind of goes along. The entire body has to be alive or else nothing is healthy.
Oh, absolutely, yes. That's right. And so the way I like to look at it is that natural selection retires in old age. The reason this happens is because if you think about when people have their children, obviously it's in the earlier part of life. This is true of however long you live, that most of your children have been born and will themselves have children first two thirds of your life. And so if you look at this at a population level, the job, if you like, of the genes, which is to transmit themselves to future generations, it's been done by the time you reach, 40 or 50.
Let me jump in here. We have to take a quick break. My guest is ecology professor Jonathan Silvertown. His new book is called The Long and the Short of It, The Science of Lifespan and Aging. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to financial planning. Spring registration is open now. You can learn more and register online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Jonathan Silvertown. He is professor of ecology at the Open University, and his new book is called The Long and the Short of It, The Science of Lifespan and Aging. Join the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org. And Jonathan, before the break, you had begun telling us about what you described as the retirement of natural selection in later life.
Yes. So I think this is actually quite a neat way of understanding just what's going on. So a good example would be the rare, thankfully, disease called Huntington's disease. And this is a sort of neurodegenerative disease that has a clear genetic basis. I think it's one gene that causes this. And it really only appears, it starts to be debilitating at the age of 30 or 40. And before that, people who suffer from this disease are pretty much unaffected. So the way this disease sort of gets transmitted is basically people have all their children and transmit the disease before they themselves are affected. The famous example of this is the folk singer Woody Guthrie, and he had Huntington's disease, and he had, I think it was something like 7 children before he was finally hospitalized with Huntington's disease. He died, I believe, in the 70s, and in the 1970s. And that's, if you like, a sort of model for what happens to genes in general, which is that anything that kicks in later life and is deleterious, it does you damage, is not going to be removed by natural selection because it's already been transmitted to your children and you've had your children. So you know, what happens after that point kind of doesn't matter to natural selection. This is a kind of depressing idea, really. but there's an upside to it, too, which is that there are genes which have had advantages in early life and disadvantages in later life. And this is a trade-off that I think you referred to earlier. And so some examples seem to be related to, for example, the immune system. So the immune system is clearly very important in the survival, especially of young children and youth and so on. So in the period that matters to natural selection, the immune system is vital to survival. But what can happen later on is that the immune system starts to attack the body. And instead of defending it, it gets sort of overexcited, if you like, and starts to attack the body's own tissues, and this happens in certain forms of arthritis, for example. But all this kicks in after you've had your children, and so the immune system is so useful to survival early in life that anything it does that's deleterious later in life is essentially outweighed in the balance when natural selection does the math.
Why do we get to live at all beyond the age where we have likely born whatever children we're going to have and likely raise them to, you know, like their early teenage years when, at least from a biological standpoint, they could survive independently?
Well, that's a good question. I think there are a variety of answers. I mean, the answer I'm going to give you in a second needs to be thought of against the background of what's happened to how long humans live now compared to how long we used to live. So 200 years ago, the average lifespan anywhere in the world was no greater than 40 years. Average, that is. Of course, some people lived a lot longer. Mm-hmm. But nowadays, there's nowhere in the world, even the poorest countries, where the average lifespan is less than 40 years. And in fact, people are living longer and longer. So when we start to think about why people live, if you like, beyond their reproductive years, we have to remember that actually, to some extent, this is a relatively recent phenomenon, and that 200 years ago, people often died not long after they'd had their children, or at least their children had been raised. And, of course, many women died in childbirth, too. So, you know, that we have to remember that when trying to explain why people live longer. It may just be that this is a very recent thing. That said, there is at least one animal in which females live for about 40 years after they stop reproducing. And certainly the phenomenon of menopause in humans, which is almost unique to our species, it does seem to suggest that the body is deliberately turning off the ability to have children while, you know, you're still healthy. And so there's this idea called the grandmother hypothesis, which is basically the best thing you can do when you reach the age of 50 is to help your daughter raise her children. Rather than have more children yourself, because having children after the age of 50 is certainly hazardous to the health of the mother and probably to the child, whereas looking after your grandchildren is certainly going to help your genes. So there's some evidence that actually works, and that in societies where you know, there's no modern medicine, things like this, older women do increase the survival chances of their grandchildren by the help they can give.
I realize that I'm going to ask for a gross generalization here, but how does body size from one animal species to the next correlate to lifespan?
With lifespan, okay. Well, it used to be thought that the correlation was really good, and Aristotle, who wrote a little book all about this very subject, interesting enough, so over 2,000 years ago. This is a perennial subject. He said lifespan correlates with the, I don't think he used the word correlate, with size. So, you know, mice are short-lived, and, you know, donkeys and horses are long-lived, and so on. This actually was a pretty well-accepted idea until people started to look at not just a handful of organisms and the ones we're familiar with, because, you know, they're on our farms and in our houses, but also, you know, many more wild animals. And then suddenly it began to emerge that actually the correlation with size, while it's kind of true at a very general level, it's not. There are lots of exceptions, and this is actually the thing about this whole subject, is that there seem to be exceptions to almost every rule. But some of those exceptions are instructive. So here's one. Here's an example. If you look at rodents on the whole are short-lived. And the biggest one is called the capybara, which is a South American rodent. It's about the size of a small dog. And it lives only about 10 years. Now, if you compare that with a house mouse, that's tiny. It lives about a year. So you say, okay, right, that makes sense. The big one lives longer. But then there's a rodent called the naked mole rat, which people may well have heard of, because I think Science magazine described it as the animal of the year this year. And it did so because the naked mole rat lives, it's about the size of a house mouse, and just a bit bigger, and it lives for up to 30 years. So the naked mole rat has some secrets of longevity that we'd dearly like to reveal, to uncover. And that's a very good example where size isn't everything. It lives far, far longer than the capybara, and it's, you know, hundreds of times smaller.
So what do you go looking for in a creature like a naked mole rat to try to understand why it can live so long?
Well, people have done all kinds of things. I mean, the first thing to look at is if it lives that long, is it suffering from cancer, or if not, why not, and this sort of thing. And recently people have discovered that there's a molecule called hyaluronic acid, which seems to be present at unusually high amounts in the tissues of the naked mole rat, and it seems to protect the cells in some way. So you look. You can look at the molecular level, that kind of thing. You can look at the cellular level. You know, what are the mutation rates? You can look at the environment. I mean, I think the driver of all this. I mean, so there's the sort of a, you can answer most of these questions at a variety of different levels. You can ask the questions about how, you know, what is it? What are the molecular mechanisms that are protecting this animal? But you can also ask questions about why. And the interesting thing about these animals that live a long time for their size or for other, you know, that seem to be the exceptions, is that they seem to be, for various ecological reasons to do with the way they live, they seem to be particularly well protected against the hazards of normal life. So the naked mole rat, as you might imagine, lives in a hole in the ground. It's social, in fact. It's really interesting. And living in holes in the ground is actually protective. So most things that live underground live longer, have longer lives than species of the same size that live above ground. Mm-hmm. And this goes also for other things that protect. So, for example, turtles that have shells live much longer than reptiles that don't have shells. Animals that are poisonous live longer than species that are not poisonous. And, you know, if you look at each of these individually, you think, oh, these are all sort of rather strange exceptions. But the thing they all have in common is that these are all different ways of protecting the animal against being eaten, usually, or other hazards of life. And it seems that actually that's something that in evolutionary time lengthens life.
It would seem clear that there are evolutionary benefits to being able to come into existence, sexually mature, and then begin to reproduce very rapidly, given, you know, hazards of disease and accidents and predators, that sort of thing. But not every organism has evolved to do this. Can you talk about the trade-offs?
Yes. Okay. So if you think naively about what natural selection is doing, is it's basically favoring those individuals that leave the most offspring. And the way, as you just said, to leave the most offspring is to start producing your babies very, very young, and then they'll start having babies young and so on. And geometric, you know, if you just multiply each generation by the one that follows, you very rapidly get hugely increasing numbers of descendants, if you like. And bacteria are the obvious example of that. And if bacterial fission, you know, they reproduce by dividing in half and again, that could produce huge numbers of offspring. So why aren't we all still, as we were for 2.8 billion years, just single-celled and behaving the way bacteria and yeast and other single-celled organisms do? And I think this is a question that people haven't really considered very, very deeply. So I'm not sure I can give you a full answer to that, but it is kind of odd. And the answer lies somewhere in the evolution of multicellularity and the kind of things I just talked about with, you know, what protects an organism. If you're in an environment where you know, choking the environment sort of copies you of yourself isn't going to work for some reason, but hanging on in there will, then natural selection will start to favor longer life. And that then favors various mechanisms for making for protecting cells and then, you know, the organism. So then you start getting mechanisms that actually protect against mutation, damaging mutations, things like that. And as these things evolve, you kind of get a runaway process, and slowly, organisms start to live longer lives, and as they get bigger, they're better protected, and you can kind of get see a sort of snowball effect. So I suspect it's something like that, but I don't really think this question's been properly answered yet.
What accounts for animals, I guess like salmon, that might reproduce once and then they die?
Well, yes. I mean, this is a really weird thing. So in Pacific salmon, but not in Atlantic salmon, interestingly enough, and this is another one of those little puzzles I don't think anybody's really answered, but in Pacific salmon, They spend about 3 years at sea as juveniles, feeding. And then in the sort of about third year, they will then swim up the river in which they were born. So they home to the river where they were born. They then swim up the river to the very place where they were, where they originated as eggs, where the spawn came from. And there they reproduce. They don't feed on the way upstream. As an aside here, I might say apparently, you know, one of the tricks of fishermen for fishing for salmon is that you've got to get these fish that don't normally feed to take your bait.
Hmm.
So that's kind of what. Anyway, that's.
I never thought about that. Yeah.
Yeah. So they swim upstream, and how far they have to swim upstream varies a great deal. In some populations, it might be only a few miles. In others, it can be hundreds of miles. And of course, since you're not feeding while you're swimming upstream, and if you aren't big enough and you try swimming a long way, then you won't make it. You won't reproduce, and that will be the end of your line, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
So what these salmon have evolved is this homing process, essentially, which means they're adapted to make the journey that they need to do to reproduce. This kind of has kind of set in stone, if you like, this homing behavior. If you swim up a river that is the wrong river, or you decide to keep going when you shouldn't, you'll run out of steam and not reproduce. So there's very strong natural selection for getting that right. And because the effort involved in doing this is really quite substantial, basically what natural selection has favored is a sort of all or nothing strategy. Don't try and make the journey home until you're big enough and strong enough. And when you are, this is such an arduous journey. You're basically going to put all your efforts into this. And the fish, when they arrive at the spawning ground...
Let me jump in. We have to take another quick break. My guest is Jonathan Silvertown. His new book is The Long and the Short of It, The Science of Lifespan and Aging. Back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to financial planning. Spring registration is open now. You can learn more and register online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Jonathan Silvertown, who's professor of ecology at the Open University Milton Keynes. His new book is called The Long and the Short of It, The Science of Lifespan and Aging. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. And Jonathan, you were telling us that these Pacific salmon essentially have to put all their eggs in one basket for this final trip home to the river in which they were born.
That's right. And then when they finally make it to the spawning grounds, they're exhausted. They've used up a lot of their body fat, their body mass. A lot of salmon don't even make it. They're eaten by, because they're these massive tasty morsels going upstream, they're eaten by bears and all sorts of animals and humans too, of course. That predation is so heavy that salmon rivers are actually fertilized by the bodies of salmon that have been caught over the thousands of years and ended up on the stream bank instead of in the river. And so this is they're always hazards. The effort itself, the danger of predation, and so on. And so if you make it, basically that's your one chance, and the salmon reproduce, and then they die.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Travis in Denton. Hello, Travis.
Hello. My question is actually in direct relation to what you've just been talking about, the lifespan of animals that mate and then die. But specifically with octopus, I think it's really interesting because well, I'm kind of embarrassed to say that my citation is actually from Wikipedia, but there was a study where
nothing wrong with that.
Well, it's, as an academic, it's kind of confusing sometimes. But anyways, there was like a study where they removed the sexual glands or something of the octopus, and the life expectancy was raised. And so it's such an interesting animal because they're so intelligent, but they only live for 5 years. And so I just wondered if there was anything, how you would respond to that.
Thanks for your call.
Okay. I think the majority of octopuses and squids and so on are as you say, they reproduce once and die. I don't think that. Well, I'm not sure what the evidence is that octopuses are intelligent. Maybe they are, but I don't think that's kind of relevant in a way. That's not a comment on your question. I just mean I don't think it affects. How long something lives. So evolution equips animals and plants to survive in the environment in which they live. In the context of the environment where you live, where they live, most animals are intelligent enough to get by. I'm not sure if that answers your question, but...
Well, let me ask you this, Jonathan. We know that human females with access to, modern medicine tend to outlive human males by not a huge percentage, but a few years. Is there some reason for that? Is it probably social, or is there something maybe inherently biological that accounts for this?
Well, I don't know the answer to that. Maybe one of your listeners does. Women do seem to be more robust than men. The medical studies suggest that women visit hospital and doctors more than men do, but actually it's men who suffer the more serious events and don't tend to visit hospitals and doctors as much and do die earlier. I think the difference in lifespan is about 4 or 5 years on average.
Please continue. I'm sorry.
Well, I was just going to say it's not huge, but it is significant.
Mm-hmm. Especially depending on whether you're male or female, it's significant.
If you're a man, absolutely.
Yeah. How do eating and metabolism play into our lifespans?
Okay, well, it's bad to be overweight. I mean, mm-hmm. We know that. The question, I guess, that motivates, your question is probably motivated by what happens at the other end. So if it's bad to be overweight, that does shorten your life. There's no question about that. Does it actually lengthen your life to eat very little? And there are people who are trying this out as an experiment. I mean, they're on very restricted diets with very restricted calories. There's some evidence in animals that does lengthen life. There's a couple of studies of primates and monkeys, in one of which it seems to, caloric restriction, as it's called, does seem to lengthen life. And in the other, it didn't seem to have that effect. And there were some differences in the two studies that perhaps explain why they came to different conclusions. So I think the jury's out as to whether it works in human beings, but there are a bunch of doctors, I believe, who are actually trying it out on themselves.
Is the jury also still out on the effect of things like antioxidants on longevity?
I think the jury has reported on that one, actually.
Okay.
Although many people aren't aware of this. So you will see so many health foods which directly or indirectly claim that they're good for you because they contain antioxidants. Some of those will be good for you because they are vegetables or fruits or those, we know that eating lots of vegetables and fruits is good for you. But it may not be the antioxidants particularly, although actually it seems that possibly some things like antioxidants are good for you when they're taken in natural form, but not necessarily when they're taken in pill form. So, it's kind of complicated. I seem to have said that before, so this is a complicated area. But it was thought for quite a long time that basically metabolism, you know, burning energy in the body, was hazardous because obviously it's essential. We can't live without it. But there's a sort of side effect, which is that these free radicals are produced. These damaging things are produced, that antioxidants, if you like, knock them out. And so, you know, the way to counteract these damaging effects of metabolism is to have lots of antioxidants. It turns out that it's a lot more complicated than that. And the studies I'm aware of are pretty equivocal about there being any kind of benefit from taking supplementary antioxidants. That's the key thing. It isn't that they aren't playing a role in the body, but it's the issue is whether taking extra in some form is going to do you any good. And if you see a claim to that effect, check out the evidence is what I would say.
What can we learn by comparing cancer rates in animals that have different average lifespans?
Okay, this is really interesting. So a guy called Pito, an epidemiologist, noticed back in the 1970s that cancer rates are very similar in old mice and old humans, even though a mouse is old at sort of 80 weeks and a human is old at 80 years. And this is really odd because, after all, there are many more cells in a human being than a mouse. Our cells are roughly the same size, and being much bigger, we've got more of them. And because we live a lot longer, our cells divide much more than those of a mouse do. So given that every cell division and every cell is, if you like, a potential cancer waiting to happen, because it's an opportunity for mutation to take hold, you'd expect there to be much higher rates of cancer in humans because we live a long time, we've got a lot of cells. And if you were to take a blue whale, which, you know, massive 100 tons or so, then you'd expect them all to be dead at a very young age because they've got so many cells, they're so big. You know, at some point, one of those cells is going to mutate, produce a cancer, and that's it. Mm-hmm. The fact that this doesn't happen, that we can live into old age, by and large, before cancer hits. I mean, there are obviously exceptions, so we're talking here statistically. And this is true of very big animals like whales and elephants and so on. What it must mean is that natural selection can control the mutation rate that affects the cancer rate. That's really the only conclusion you can come to, that these things are adjusted during the course of evolution to the length of life. And that's good news, because if natural selection, the way I like to think of it is that each animal, each plant, each species, if you like, is like a separate experiment, a central natural experiment, not an experiment on our behalf or by us, but a separate experiment in evolution in how to live. And if some of these experiments have actually lowered the cancer rate such that you can live to 80 or 100 years, then there's something really interesting going on there, and potentially we can find out what it is and use that to fix cancer when it occurs.
Well, we know that plants can get cancers, but you mentioned earlier in passing that this doesn't threaten their lives the way it threatens animals. Why not?
Right. Well, there are a couple of reasons. I mean, one is that a plant cell is in a box, a box of cellulose. Mm-hmm. An animal cell isn't. An animal cell is sort of in a kind of flimsy bag, which is very permeable. Things can go across the membrane and the cells can proliferate very easily, but plant cells are kind of boxed in. So that's one reason. Another is that there's no sort of circulatory system in plants the way there is in animals. So, you know, we have a blood circulation, and that's how cancer cells get around the body. So they might start, say, in the prostate gland, and then, you know, proliferate and pass through the blood into other places where they then start to cause a problem, and that's metastasis, which is what kills a lot of cancer patients. That just can't happen in plants because there's no circulatory system. And then I think the final reason is the one I mentioned at the beginning, which is that, you know, you have these very strict controls on mutation rates and things in plants that aren't as general in animals, because it's only the germ cells, the ones that produce the sperm and the eggs, that natural selection really looks after. And the body cells, it lets go after a while. But in plants, it doesn't do that. And so, you know, I think for all these three major reasons, you tend not to get anything that you call a cancer in plants.
Is there any way that we can focus our efforts on living better within the lifespans that we have and somehow shortening the time at which, at the end of many human lives, people are really in decline for a number of years?
Well, this is happening already. People observed that we humans are living longer and longer, the fear was that people would end up, essentially the older human population would end up being entirely decrepit, mm-hmm. and a burden on the rest of society, if you like, let's put it that way. And while there is some truth in that, as people live longer, the number of cases of Alzheimer's disease and so on is certainly going up. It is not the case that all old people suffer that way. One of the reasons people live longer is because of better health care, because of greater prosperity. So, you know, we live in warm, dry houses if you live in a damp climate like I do. It's just a lot healthier. We have public sanitation, all these kinds of things. So actually, we live longer because we're healthier. And so we reach old age in a better state of health. Not true for everybody, unfortunately, but statistically speaking, that's kind of what's happening.
Do you, in a word or two, what do you think the ultimate human lifespan might be? If we could
Ooh,
get a handle on disease.
I'm not going to stick my neck out on that, because there's an interesting paper written showing that historically, when people have, well-informed people better informed than I am, have made these guesses, it takes about 10 years for them to be proved wrong. Ask me back in 10 years.
All right. Jonathan Silvertown is professor of ecology at the Open University and author of the new book, The Long and the Short of It, The Science of Lifespan and Aging. Jonathan, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
A pleasure.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.